right, everybody, welcome to part three of Help Me Save the Netflix original movie, The Titan, with Sam Worthington. Now, today we're going to be focusing on The Mad Scientist. Now, if you've watched the other two episodes, which I hope you have, or listened to them, you can listen to this as a podcast. And as I said, even though we're watching clips of the movie, I do my best to kind of explain what's going on, and then you can hear the dialogue to kind of see what's happening, or to hear what's happening. And in the first two episodes, I focused one on kind of the motivation for why you should care, and why as art and what's going on with this story and how it represents a broader genre, but that this is important for all of us to, one, go into and understand, because it actually affects our lives. And then the other part was that there's a lot more going on, that this is a movie that is lambasted and destroyed by critics, and even audience members didn't like it. And the problem with that is that a lot of people, in my opinion, the big problem there is that the critics are not doing their job, which is their job is not to find fancy and fun, witty ways for themselves to look good by using words that people don't really understand to tear apart something that doesn't make sense to an audience member. Their job as a critic is to find good work, especially in today's over-robust marketplace, and to teach you how to enjoy it, to teach you how to see what you wouldn't normally be seeing. So, and then at the end of that first video, I talked about the elements, the lighting, cinematography, Dutch camera angles, things like that, as well as characters and the roots that this movie is very aware of in the imagery of filmmaking, and how it's aware of its literary roots in a lot of ways that most, except for some of the better sci-fi movies, are not as aware of. And then in the second one, I focused on who I argued was the protagonist. So even though in this poster you see Sam Worthington, he's the bigger star, and you see his wife, and I forget the actress's name. So this is Rick, and this is Abby, his wife. And that's really all that's important. The actors don't matter. We're talking about story, not about how Hollywood makes movies or how Netflix makes movies. So, or how they buy movies from production design into companies. But anyway, so the interesting thing is that there's in the Eden complex, which we talked about last time, formulated or exposed in very clear terms in Nathaniel Hawthorne's work, Nathaniel Hawthorne being the 19th century most influential American author, one of the world's most influential authors, and an influential American author to this day. Even, The Scarlet Letter, of course, is obvious, and The House of Seven Gables, where there is elements of the fantastic in those. But his short stories is what we're going to be focusing on today, particularly Dr. Heidegger's Experiment, Rappaccini's Daughter, and The Birthmark. Now, in the second video that I did, I focused on the protagonist was not Rick, as most people seem to assume or believe, but the main character is actually Abigail, the wife, the redeeming character. And we're going to talk more about this in this episode, and especially in the finale that I'll be doing next one, where I'll be covering more of the criticism as I can, but then also pointing out some of the subplots and then coming up with the main idea, the main structure of the story, and what is called the Oedipal structure. It's a very classic Oedipal structure, which is basically what all sci-fi stories are. And for the most part, you're going to see this with most science fiction stories. So in this video, we will be talking about The Mad Scientist. And his name is Dr. Collingsworth, I believe. I think his name is only mentioned twice, and it doesn't seem to take much prominence, which is pretty common because a lot of times these characters are, meshed into basically almost a cliche, you could call it, which isn't a bad thing in the sense that that is what the genre is. This is a very, very common character that you see over and over again. And that's just the way it is. So anyway, I think this is an important character to understand, because the last video I argued that this character, Abigail, is the main character, and that the fight in the conflict is actually between Abigail and this gentleman here, the mad scientist. And what we're getting when we're watching this movie is really there's two power struggles that are happening. One is very broad and not fleshed out very clearly until the very end. Then we see something. And one is much more in your face and part of the structure of the story. So, for instance, in the first video, I pointed out that there's an indication immediately in the first lines of the movie, the first dialogue of the movie, that which is good dialogue, that there's exposition between Sam Worthington's character and the army soldier who's taking them into the garden, the island of Dr. Moreau, the island of this mad scientist, which is this whole thing is a microcosm under the purview of this scientist who we know to be a manipulator and a liar, which we're going to talk about. He lies all the time. So you can't trust anything that he says. And this is actually very common. This goes back to the epistolary type of stories of Frankenstein, and especially the dominant influence from this movie is the island of Dr. Moreau, where Pendrick, who is found out to be a liar. And so you're always asking yourself, or especially at the end of that story, when he goes to the island of Dr. Moreau, he finds this doctor who's experimenting with vivisection on animals to make them men. And, you know, we get a kind of critique on colonialism at that time, which, you know, in the late 19th century, you have Britain and France as these two dominant colonial figures. You get this kind of discussion that H.G. Wells is saying about the kind of lies the people in power are going to be saying to get what they want, in a sense. And that's what you're getting here, is that this individual, this mad scientist, has a lot going on, which again is one of the reasons why I want to save this movie, because there is so much going on that people aren't looking at, and it's not their fault. I think we're not trained anymore to see things for the layers that are happening in them. And the story, whether you know all the literature or not, is clearly there. Like, you get this if you watch the movie, and this is the type of movie that's worth watching more than once, because you'll notice little interactions that you would not have noticed in the past. So let's watch, I'm going to skip around a little bit, but let's watch a little bit of the scenes between Dr. Jansen over here, the female, and Dr. Collingsworth, I believe. Or Collingswood. I forget his name.
Hi, Abigail. How was your trip?
There it is, Collingwood. Collingwood.
Collingwood. It is so good to see you.
So I'm going to skip
one second. How teaching the path means to you.
It's going to get sick.
So this is an important scene, is they're going to be walking. It's Abigail and the doctor Collingwood walking down a pathway, and he's going to explain his philosophy. And this is critical. This is very critical.
Isn't he?
Temporarily. He'll need committed aftercare. He won't see him himself at times.
Rick crossed the Syrian desert injured and alone without food or water for 3 days.
Well, this will make that look like a walk in the park. But we'll get through it. Dr. Jansen, I admire your courage. Rick wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you. I want to tell you that I'm grateful.
You don't have to charm me, Professor. I've studied your work. I know what we're doing here. It's bigger than all of us.
Yes, 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 I know that. But it's the concessions you made. Medical career, the nights of worry.
It's a small price to pay for my son's future.
No one attempts the impossible without belief in something greater than themselves, even if that something is a someone. Rick didn't cross the desert alone.
So we get the idea, and you know, even the first time I saw this, I knew that that was a critical moment, because the question in Nathaniel Hawthorne's short story, which is one of the first, you know, great science fiction stories, And it's very short. It's called Dr. Heidegger's Experiment, and it's about Dr. Heidegger, who invites his good old respectable friends, and said very ironically, he keeps repeating that in the passage, the good old respectable friends, because they're not very good. They're definitely old, but they're not respectable at all. And I'm not going to go into too much detail on this, but the idea of the story is, one of the big questions is, what exactly is the experiment? Is the experiment that, you know, he brings the fountain of youth, or a pitcher of water from the fountain of youth, they drink it and they grow young, and then they become immoral and salacious and lascivious and, you know, very over-sexualized and mad and crazy, and then they knock over the pitcher, and then they grow old again, and then they go crazy, like literally at the end, they have a fever pitch of wanting to spend the last moments of their lives, not in trying to be moral, but in trying to find the fountain of youth. And so the question is, what is the experiment? And you get a sense in the Heidegger's Experiment, if you read it very carefully, you know, it's established as they're in the old study of old Dr. Heidegger. And this, by the way, is before the word scientist has even been coined. And so, but it is after Frankenstein. So we have this modern science is beginning, you know, it's the origins of modern science is really coming into its own, where they're electrocuting frogs, or, you know, putting electrical currents through frogs and it twitches their legs, which is the idea for Frankenstein. You electrify, you know, a dead mass and it becomes a human. So we get this kind of feeling in Heidegger that there's an experiment going on that the fountain of youth is only an illusion, and it was always only an illusion. Now, Dr. Heidegger is just trying to prove something about the morality of it. But this idea of a doctor creating not only the serum that the doctor gives, but the whole thing is an experiment, is a test, is, you know, you're rats in a maze. And you get that very clearly with the introduction of the Igor character, which is this, you can't see her, but it's this lady in a pantsuit. She looks very much like a man in a lot of ways. She's very, desexualized. And you get this when she introduces them to the house. So remember, they go, you know, from the darkness into this island, which is a garden paradise that's overseen by a godlike character. And the same thing as Dr. Moreau, same thing. And you get this in Heidegger. And then again, you get this in The Birthmark, which is, you know, the story by Nathaniel Hawthorne that is, you know, a very powerful story about a scientist or a doctor, again, terminology of scientist, about a doctor who wants to perfect a small little thing about his wife. She has a little birthmark, and he wants to make her perfect. He wants to make her better. He wants to use his science to make her the perfect being that she can be. And in the end, he ends up killing her by having her, you know, ingest this liquid, this serum that he has created. But in the process of doing this, he actually experiments with her by putting her in a room that looks very lavish and beautiful for her, but it's actually an experiment. He's putting in chemicals, he's putting in different temperatures, doing things like that. All things that happen in this house. So this house, which they're introduced to, is this. They think it's this beautiful, lavish. Like, welcome. The door opens. It's a garden paradise again. So it's a garden paradise within a garden paradise.
There's two bedrooms upstairs. And don't listen to Jim. Call me day or night. Thank you.
And what you, Freya is the name of Igor. And what you get with the, you know, this paradise, and you even get this immediately with the imagery, which was echoed. The same kind of imagery is in Ex Machina, if you saw that movie. But this imagery of open glass, which is very viewable, like everybody can see you, is the kind of feeling you get from the camera. It's like, You look around and there's glass everywhere, and actually it's great imagery that Abigail, if you're listening, she's now standing in basically a glass box, again, like a rat in a maze. And so that this idea, and this is one thing that the critics were talking about that really pisses me off, because it really seems like they just don't know what the hell they're talking about at all. because, you know, they say like the house doesn't make sense because she finds out it's surveilled. And she does, you know, that plays no role in the plot, but the surveillance and the discovery of the surveillance is only part of the whole structure of this whole thing. She's in an experiment. She's a rat in a maze. Like, that's what she starts to discover, and that it's all controlled by this very powerful godlike figure, the figure of Dr. Moreau or Collingwood, and that is the mad scientist. Okay, so the next scene I want to talk about is next thing I want to talk about is the scene that I said I would talk about in the beginning, but I kept skipping and I forgot. Again, and that's the scene where one character, Hernandez, I believe, raises his hand to ask a question. And this is an interesting moment because if you remember from the first video episode of this four-part series, I talked about how this is what I call in all science fiction movies, pretty much, especially dystopian future ones like, you know, WALL-E or anything where we're kind of destroying the world. This is the Elon Musk premise. He's acting on this premise. Is the idea that we have this perfect garden paradise that was given to us by something. It's just ours. You know, it's a religious idea, which was not the idea that everybody has had. It's not the only idea about the world, you know, that it's this perfect paradise that we're fucking it up. The actual way to look at it is that, you know, the water stained, that, you know, there's not much we could do with it. A lot of places are deserts. You can't do anything with that. And that we have to use our minds to transform it in order to make it livable. And otherwise, you know, if you don't believe me, just go out into the world, out of civilization, completely naked, and you'll be dead very quickly. So it's important that we know that we have to transform this world to make it into something. That's one worldview. The worldview in science fiction that is only worldview in science fiction is that Earth is a paradise that we're screwing up. And, you know, in the first episode of this series, I talked about the list that the Doctor iterates. And that is the list that you hear in real life that's actually affecting our policies today. And it's one that we all, you know, shake our heads to. Oh, yeah, yeah, we're doing that. Which is, you know, again, harkens back to the Bible, harkens back to Dante, harkens back to Milton, harkens back to Gothic literature, Frankenstein, Hawthorne, so on, Wells, and, you know, all the way to our modern day. You see this in Ex Machina. You see this in, Minority Report. Every science fiction movie, that's actually what I would consider a science fiction movie. So the point I'm trying to make is that this is a, that scene, and he is explaining, or he has explained why they are transforming themselves to go to Titan. And then you get one person who just asks some questions about, you know, is this safe? Is this real science? He's representing something outside of the little community garden that this godlike scientist has done. And just look at how the Rick character, who again is basically a blind follower. So we talked about this in the last video. Rick is a blind follower and he relies exclusively on his wife. And because his wife trusts the doctor, which the trust changes later, then Rick stops trusting the doctor. He becomes suspicious. And he starts to look at his wife for more guidance and away from the doctor. So right now you'll see how much Rick is just a blind, obedient follower of the doctor. And so this is a very good criticism of being a blind, you know, obedient follower of somebody who's purporting these things about the world and what we should do about it. But, you know, I don't know if the movie had that in mind. So let's watch the scene where the objector just ask a couple questions and look at what Rick does to him or what he says.
Dr. Hernandez, I was waiting for you to object.
I still don't understand how our bodies won't reject the treatment.
Clinical trials were successful, signed off by NATO Science and Technology Office.
You're talking forced evolution.
I'm talking survival of the species.
HPA axis reprogramming. Methane lipid bilayer injections, G-force training underwater.
There are no guarantees, Dr. Hernandez. Some people won't take to the drugs. Some people will break during the training. Most of you will fail and be sent home.
How many of us will die?
$20 says Iker goes first.
Can you read?
What?
I said, can you read, idiot? Because if you could, you see that this book is just a bunch of health warnings.
Why are you here?
I'm just pointing out that
you're
this
is playing nothing, and you're going on and on. He's talking about the end of the earth. You got kids?
No.
Shut the fuck up or get the fuck out. Please, go on, Professor.
So again, you know, like that, the guy is just asking questions about this dramatic thing they're going to do to their body and who's going to live. And then Rick says, you know, shut the, you know, do you have kids? Well, no. So then shut the hell up or shut the fuck up and or get the fuck out. And it's like, that's the same kind of argument we hear today where again, you know, this is the environment, what I call the environmentalist wet dream, because this is the world is at, in this world of the Titan, the world is coming to an end. It's not theoretical as it is in our world, where it's just one hypothesis, I should say. It's not even a theory. It doesn't deserve, environmentalists, you know, don't really deserve the terminology theory at this point. It's a hypothesis and a bad one. But, you know, even if to what the degree they're right, the idea that the world is absolutely coming to an end, which has been predicted for over 100 years, is crazy. But in this movie, it's real. And we have to take it as real. And that's, I think, you know, an interesting part of the science fiction and how art affects our lives in real life. So anyway, I wanted to point that out because the relationship between Rick and the doctor. And the doctor is, if you remember, the Eden Complex, the six elements of the Eden Complex, which is what would, you know, is considered a, one way to look at it is like a phenomenological complex. So it's just the attributes that you can see in all science fiction movies or stories in general that are actually infecting our minds, whether we realize it or not. So we have this godlike or someone who seeks to be godlike character. And of course, as I said, there's an Oedipal structure, which he's opposed to, not Rick, but Abby. Abby is the other alternative worldview that we have here, which we'll see in a little bit here in a few minutes. Okay, in this scene we get the Igor character, again, sexless clothes, and she's, you know, she's part of the story, but it's interesting. I haven't figured out exactly what role she's supposed to play, except, you know, disappear and be, at the beginning, she's an arm or a tool, as she is in Hawthorne's short stories. By the way, there was no Igor in the Frankenstein novel. The novel by Shelley doesn't have any Igor assistant at all. This was a later attachment, I think, based on the work of Nathaniel Hawthorne and a few, and maybe others, but who did include in their science fiction stories of this type of, you know, scientist gone mad who puts his own view of science and his own desire for knowledge above humanity and moral considerations, that there is a mad scientist or an Igor character. And for instance, the birthmark, Almir has Amminadab. And this is like this cloth, a man of clay, this, you know, creature that's not as intelligent, just a worker of the field. And, but basically he's just a product of Almir's will. He does what Almir wants, period. And that's kind of what this character, the female Igor, wants or does as well. She just does what she's supposed to do. Later in the story, she does what Abigail wants to do. So she's basically who's in control of the power within the story controls this character. So now she's under completely the control of Collingworth or the Collingwood, the mad scientist. So watch what happens here, though, because this is the big shift that a lot of people make. And it's been happening because there's been these experiments. Abigail is starting to become slightly suspicious of what's going on. You know, she sees the kind of monster come into her husband, and she's starting to become just a little suspicious because he's getting sick. You know, he's getting very sick, and she's not sure what's happening. So watch what Rick does in relation to Abigail. And this experiment, remember, this is the doctor's experiment.
May I?
So I hope you noticed that if you're not watching and you're listening, the moment she brings out the needle for another one of those 300 shots, he sits back. It's a very good moment. Like, I think people are underestimating the purposefulness of this movie. He sits back and he immediately reacts to it. You know, like a dog being, you know, like a switch being hit, swung at a dog. after it's already been hit several times. And he's kind of like an animal in a certain sense. And he looks at his wife for guidance. What do I do? What do I do?
Pills of flunarizine, a calcium channel blocker. This is potassium citrate, help flush the kidneys. Potassium citrate's taken.
So he's looking at her like, I don't know what's going on. What do I do? And she's the doctor now. Now she has started to wrest control of the knowledge that is, passed on or that has been discovered by this mad scientist.
Not orally, but it's in magnesium sulfate, so it bypasses the gastric tract.
How much magnesium?
10 grams.
That's high.
I think that's great acting, by the way. People keep attacking this acting, but it's point straight on point. It's perfect with this power struggle going on right here.
I'd like to speak with Professor Collingwood. Well, he's not here right now, so as soon as he's free, I'll get him to come see you.
She hasn't fully wrested control. He's nervous. Look at his body language. You know, he's scared little pup. I mean, he's like a scared little pup. And she's like this confident, doctor in charge of this whole thing. And she says, she caresses him, shakes her head, yes. And then he goes. So again, I think people criticizing this just don't know what the hell's going on. There's so much going on. Now he's sick and she's, terrified. And this is when she, that disgusting scene when she puts the cotton swab on his vomit, the bloody vomit, to find out what's going on. And then of course, so immediately after, that was the last moment where she accepted control from the doctor. And then she realizes, oh my gosh, she's in this house that's monitoring her. Now I want to talk about that in a second. Let me skip forward to when she confronts the doctor. This is after he gets his eye surgery, and then he starts bleeding from the eyes, and then Abigail takes him to the hospital. And then she confronts the doctor with all of her new evidence. And this is all within a few minutes, but a lot has been conveyed in terms of the inner struggle. And she has now crossed the point. This is the point in the story where she has crossed the moment where she now, she wants to wrest control officially from the doctor. And that's, like I said, underlies the whole conflict here.
What did you do?
Abby, please.
He is blind.
That's only temporary.
You did not tell me everything.
Now look, you're tired? Go home, get some rest. Freya will take care of
you. There are cameras in our house. I know you've been watching us.
That was the Pentagon's idea. It was for your security and ours. I argued against it at the time.
If you don't like it, I'll get rid of them, he said. So, we know him to be a liar now. Is that the truth, what he just said? Probably not. Maybe it is the truth. Maybe there was some truth to it. But we don't know. We can no longer trust this character at all. Nothing he says is necessarily true. So all the things, so the question from Dr. Heidegger's experiment is who is actually, what exactly is the experiment? Is it actually giving them Fountain of the Youth? Or is it the doctor setting up this scenario, this whole world for them? Right, where he chose the four friends for a reason. He chose very specifically in the story, he chose a politician, he chose a businessman, and he chose a soldier. And then he chose a young maiden, or an old maiden who was a young man. And then they all loved the woman at one point. So when he gives them the Fountain of Youth, you look at how they interact with the woman, and they all try to sleep with her, and they all try to fight, and they have these crazy schemes for making money for the businessman. And, the soldier just wants to drink and blah, blah, blah. And so the experiment is actually the whole thing, not just the fountain, but the whole world, the mirrors on the wall, the scary tome, the cobwebs in the corner, all of it is set up to put them in a certain mindset and to manipulate them. And you get this again with the birthmark with Almir, where the room that he puts her in, Georgiana, he puts Georgiana in a room in order to learn from her or to experiment on her and see what she's doing. He puts perfumes, he pumps in different atmosphere and things of that nature, and it changes her environment. But the whole thing is that kind of world. And in Rappaccini's Daughter, you get this really intensely, where this is probably his most famous and most influential science fiction short story. And it the Dr. Rappaccini raises his daughter on the poisons of the most poisonous flowers that he has even manipulated to be even more poisonous. And she herself becomes poisonous. And the whole thing we discover, including Giovanni, the character who falls in love with Beatrice, the Beatrice, the daughter of Rappaccini, he looks down. The whole thing we learn is an experiment in that him finding there's an old servant woman who conveniently finds a secret passage to meet Beatrice. All of this is arranged by the doctor. And so we learn that the doctor, Rappaccini, is actually not only manipulating his daughter's, you know, physiological system through the manipulation of these odors and poisons to make her powerful and strong and poisonous as well as beautiful, but he's also manipulating Giovanni's emotions by putting him in a certain sequence, by letting him see certain things but not other things. The Gothic tower that he's in itself, it's all part of the experiment. Just like in, you know, you get this in Wells's work as well with the Island of Dr. Moreau, and that's what's happening here. The same thing. This doctor has shaped this whole world, and she is, so this is my main point. She, Abigail, is part of the experiment. Because what did he say at the beginning? Rick did not go through the desert alone. He understands that, you know, that not only will his chemical processes, his 300 shots, be required to change Rick into Homo Titanius, he also needs Abigail. He needs her to, you know, he needs to manipulate her to convince Rick to go through this, to continue to go through this. So he understands that all, that's why he's watching to see what's going on between them. And he needs her as much as he needs Rick. She is the moral compass for Rick. Rick has no guide. Rick is, you know, he has no inner self in a certain way, which, you know, you could say that that's bad. And that, but this is a short story. There's only so much you could do with the short story. It's really about her and her ability to guide Rick.
If you don't like it, I'll get rid of them.
There is something alive inside of him. Something that your fucking book doesn't talk about. He is changing.
I need to keep this under control.
He needs to keep it under control. So we're getting signs over and over again that all of this is the manipulation of the doctor.
Rick needs me. Lucas needs you. Go home. We'll talk about this later.
Okay, now the next scene is he is talking to the space agency. So one conclusion I'm going to have is that many critics don't seem to understand what's happening with the final, with the finale of this movie, and they criticize the finale as the worst finale in science fiction history. And I take it to be a very clear, you know, I don't know if it's, I wouldn't call it the best, that, you know, in terms of science fiction movies. I don't know if there is any great ones, but this one is definitely a good ending, and it makes a lot of sense given the structure and what's going on in the story. But in this scene, you're going to see, or hear, the doctor arguing with the space, with NASA, the Dr. Blake here, over control of the island. And thus, again, remember, this is control over the future of the world, because the question here is that there's 10 to 15 years left on this planet. And the question is, how are they going to solve that problem? And the doctor has the idea of bio, and, you know, not terraforming, not space science, quote unquote, terraforming, but instead bioengineering, and thus turning you into Homo Titanius.
Blake, you had your shot at funding us and you blew it.
Blew it? Are you nuts? We want to shut you down.
Anything now comes from envy and resentment and is without merit.
What has no merit is your knee-jerk program based on unproven science.
So that's a pretty arrogant statement. You know, it's like, you know, this NASA person, you lost your chance. So again, this science, the Dr. Collingwood, the mad scientist, is going farther and farther down this arrogant track of egomaniacal, you know, idea of, this is what I want to do. I don't care what the costs are.
Science and your irrational ideas about forced evolution. You're so desperate to prove it, you won't even admit that you dove blindly.
There's nothing blind here. Either catch up or stop holding me back.
So that's an important moment too, because it'll come back in the end. I'll bring it back up, but so the NASA scientist is unconvinced about this quote unquote blind science. We know at the end that it did work. And so that's why it's important to understand the Titan II program has a NASA sign on it. But We'll talk about that in just a second. The other thing to remember is that the doctor, the mad scientist here, is, you know, he is standing outside of the community, and there is a standing outside of a certain community. So it's, again, it's a conflict between these communities. Just like I said in the first lines of the dialogue from the first video that I showed, is you now have the you know, here's NATO. If you're listening, there's a NATO guy on the left. There's an army soldier to the right of the doctor. There's the Igor character. And then there's his Igor character, the NATO person's Igor character. They're basically identical across from each other. You know, it's three and three, basically, on each side. And then in the center of the shot, we have the space agency Dr. Blake, who represents a whole nother set of communities. So you have all these different conflicts going on, and they're all represented in the action between Dr. Abigail, or Dr. Jansen, the wife, and the doctor, the mad scientist Collingwood. And again, this character in the middle here represents a whole new way of doing things, because so just to remind you, remember the premise is that the world is actually coming to the end, and they're fighting over the knowledge, or the way to progress, the way to use knowledge and science to move forward and save the human race. So we're going to, you know, Abigail discovers the idea of Homo Titanius, and we have this scene here. She sees the evolution, and then we're going to see the doctor, mad scientist guy.
This isn't space research. It's criminal and morally repugnant. They're becoming violent, losing control. The last people to try this were the Nazis. You are lying to
nobody. Gives a shit. This is NATO's call. NASA's just advising.
So he says, so he goes down the power structure to keep doing what he wants to do. That's why the main story here is, again, a Frankenstein story, where the mad scientist doesn't care about the community. He doesn't care about human lives. He only cares about the science and the knowledge. So he doesn't care how many people he kills. He doesn't care how much he has to lie. The ends justify the means. And that's what the whole story is about. Because watch what happens with the NATO soldier.
Let's make it clear.
Let's make it clear.
I want this off my base.
So the doctor first went to, we could assume there's a progress of what he went through to get his funding and to do what he wants to do with his project. First, he went to NASA. They blew it. They didn't fund him. Then he goes to these other, you know, joint factions. They funded it, and then they used the NATO base. Now, when he's right on the verge of his breakthrough, the NATO person wants him off the base, so then he has to rely on...
Well, then you better call Field Marshal Howard at NATO or the Secretary of Defense at the Pentagon, because they own your base.
Boom. So now you have the conflict there. The NATO guy doesn't have any control anymore at this point. You know, later he'll have control because he's going to have all the guns. But right now he doesn't have that. So again, we have this power struggle. The doctor does not care. He does not care at all what's going on with his people. You know, with this, as long as his science works, or he gets his scientific way. Okay, this scene, real quick, is you know, again, the doctor. This is, again, another pivotal scene where the conflict between the doctor and Dr. Jansen. So to fix the blindness, or to fix the what they did to with his, the chemicals and the surgery, his brain, Rick's brain, is rejecting this. The only way to fix it is surgery. And Abigail says,
surgery.
That's not going to happen.
Without it, Rick's brain will...
Tell me the truth.
Tell me the truth. So what is the truth? It's a battle over truth.
Stop it.
No! No!
The moment that Rick tells her to stop it, he has no power in this at all. She's like, boom, no, no. She slams her fist down. You know, again, amazing, amazing story structure. The director was... I mean, everything was great about this.
I won't sit here.
And the doctor even leans back. He's like, oh, shit. Now we have a power struggle. I'm going to have to come clean, maybe.
And watch him turn my husband into a fucking animal.
We are in uncharted waters, Abigail.
What are we actually doing here?
During the first treatment, we injected the subjects with an enzyme that could alter human DNA.
You mean animal DNA?
Well, you...
He's given you a name. Do you know that? You're calling them Homo Titanians, right?
So now that she has the knowledge, she is much more confident.
It's a new species of man, yes.
If these enzymes are doing the work, how can you be sure that his body doesn't just mutate the eyes out altogether or develop membranes like a reptile? How can you possibly know what he is becoming?
We don't know. Nature is unpredictable. Everybody evolves in a different way. But I know for a fact that if Rick doesn't have surgery, within 48 hours he will lose control of his emotions, and in 72 hours he will be dead. All we can do is move forward and hope and pray.
It's a great shot of the garden too, after the doctor, the mad scientist, you know, puts his point that there's only one way forward. So he has manipulated this whole thing in this experiment, in this very pristine, again, if you saw Ex Machina, they did the same kind of thing with this imagery. The same, you know, you're in a glass box. There's a godlike creature looking in at your world, you know, like the Santa Claus figure who can see your every movements, right? And so you have that going on, and then you know, now there's this it's again the last move that the mad scientist has to wrest control and to keep control of his domain.
You said the test results were successful.
I said not everybody would survive.
So we get, again, two alternative versions. Remember in the scene, you know, so he's totally lying in order to get what he wants. It's very clear. And then if you remember in that scene when he's battling against the objector, Igor Hernandez, the guy who raises his hand, what Igor says is, you don't know what this is going to do. The science is unproven. And then he said, you know, the mad scientist said something like, but this isn't about, Igor says, this is about forced evolution. He says, it's about the survival of the species, right? It's about, you know, that's what it's really about. That's the battle. So again, we're talking about what should we do to our bodies? What's the future? Where's the, you know, where's right and wrong in all of this?
We lied.
I told you what you needed to know at the time.
You said you would become you, but better. That's what you said.
And you will. I have more than hope in you, Rick. I have faith.
There's so much I could say about that. That part, that I have faith, is so prevalent in all of these science fiction stories that at the end of it, but you know, at the end of the day, and this is goes back to so much about what science fiction is, a very rich literature and genre. But anyway, so you have, you know, now we know that for sure that the doctor has been manipulating the wife, the kid, the and Rick, of course, through all of this in order to get his experiment done. Okay, so now we have the final scene between Jantz. This is the climax, I suppose you could say, of the whole conflict. That the conflict has been building up. Which community, which possessor of knowledge will we move forward with? Will it be the Abigail doctor or the mad scientist Dr. Collingworth in charge of this whole procedure?
Kill your family. Just walk away with Lucas.
What will they do?
Go fuck yourself.
Now she refuses, you know, so she's showing her powers like, I'm gonna die for this. And that's the whole point of her morality and what she's all about. What she's all about is her family and doing the moral, using science morally. That's the whole point, is that she's there. And then, you know, the Igor character does the same thing, you know, does the same thing. I think that they would have made the character better. Well, maybe not. This is actually pretty good, because you have, like, she's standing in front of Abigail, and she's now the handmaiden, or the hand, the arm of Dr. Abigail Janssen. What does the egomaniacal doctor do?
Shoot them.
He says, shoot them.
What?
Shoot them!
He wants to transcend, you know, go above moral norms. No. You never shoot women and children?
No, I'm not shooting two unarmed women and a child.
Are you losing your minds? Look at what we've got. That's our research. That's what we bled for. I made him. But if we can't control him, all of us are dead. All of us.
So again, ends justify the means, this is you. That was a little melodramatic, but I mean, it gets the point across. So now there's been a success, or there's been a transference of power. He was the one in power. I mean, that's why I think this movie is way underestimated, is because that was very overdramatic, but the transference of power question is the whole point of this story. Between the overseer and Dr. Janssen, one of the manipulators, manipulated, and then she overcomes this. She defeats the enemy, you know, by putting her, again, she sacrifices. If you remember what the doctor said at the beginning, he chose the subjects for his experiment because they were willing to put themselves above others, right? And you need that in order to, in this world, move forward and with the experiment and go through the transition. Because you're going to be killing yourself. You're sacrificing who you are to become who you can become in the future. And she does the same thing by putting her body in front of her husband. And so the overall community sees that, and boom, they are connected. Now, this is the part that people seem super confused about, and I don't understand why they're so confused. People seem to not understand this ending, and they say, like, it's so weird that he's standing on that Rick is standing on the planet. Remember, we have the conflict is resolved, and now we have the resolution, which is, who is now in charge of the knowledge for the future of mankind? It's Abigail. Her family's a miracle. She did. But here's the twitch, issue with that. So look at all the you know, we have the mad scientist room again. So she, you know, we have all the chemical apparatus, we have the beakers, all the imagery of scientists and what they do, you know. And again, we have things here like Titan II program, so we know this is something new here. This is a new program. This is now Titan I was under the auspices of the mad scientist. But here's the thing, the NASA guy in the plane ride, the NASA space scientist, Dr. Blake, who was arguing with the mad scientist earlier, he looks down and says, you did it. So there is something about that. It's, you know, there is a kind of question that it's necessary to rely on the madness of someone like that, but that we have to wrest control from those madmen and go forward more diligently, because the space scientists could never have come up with this whole bioengineering thing, and which I have to say, bioengineering is a real thing. There is such a thing. This is like a dream of man for thousands of years, the ability to perfect our bodies and to make ourselves better. You know, it is one of the alchemist's dreams, that science fiction is a big, you know, part, a big history of that. Anyway, so you have this new program. So Titan 1 was one person's control. Titan 2 is another person's control. Who's in control of this? No critic seems to observe this, but check this out. Who's obviously in control? It's very good imagery here. So we have, you know, her in a much more, Abigail is much more casual attire than some of the other. Well, maybe that's not true. And she walks. Yeah, she's not in a uniform, right? They're in a uniform, a t-shirt with a certain label on it. There's a woman sitting at the microscope as she sees Abigail come up. She gets up, right? That is a really good touch because that shows you very clearly who's in charge of Titan 2 without having to say any words, without having to do anything. That's great filmmaking. So Abigail is clearly in charge.
School.
Her son comes to get her to say go outside. And now we see NASA has, we even see a rocket in the background here. This is a great shot here. So we see that this new program is what is the future for mankind. And that is, again, bioengineering to get you to space. So that if you think about that, that should be pretty clear why the ending is what it is. In terms of, you know, her son comes out of the domes here, the NASA Titan II program. So they're funding this. They're letting her be in control. She looks up at space. And then what do we see? So we go into space, and then we get to Titan. And her husband is there alone. Now, how is he going to overcome this? So it's the two of them looking out across space together. How is he going to? So he is now the fully realized figure from the doctor's dreams. How is he going to bring his family there? His wife is going to do it. That's the whole point of this. And she has 10 years to do it. So when the doctor at the beginning said that this is going to be more difficult than what he did with Syria, what he did with walking across the Syrian desert is going to be like a walk in the park. You know, he has to survive on this barren wasteland. People, critics make all these weird things about, hey, here's, he's on this island. How is he surviving there now that he's on Titan? It's like, that's such a stupid question. Like, they just bioengineered a Homo Titanius. That's your question? Like, get out of here. It's a science fiction story. You don't have to describe every detail of everything. They flew him to Titan. You don't think they flew food that he could survive on? Or like, they don't have a new way that he survives? Maybe he could survive 400 days without food. I mean, it's just such a stupid question that people have that kind of worry about it. Worry about what the fuck is going on in the story, dummy. So anyway, you can tell these critics are pissing me off. That is the conflict. And I hope that this... You know, I hope that this was helpful to you in kind of seeing what's going on in the story. I know that this is long. This is part three. I'm going to do another part to kind of focus on one last little element. And, and then we'll just kind of wrap up and be pretty short about it with that last one. We'll be quick. So hope you enjoyed this, and I will see you next time.